Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlanka again with another episode from Sri Aurobindo, The Hour of God. Nothing in nature is free from inequalities, except the forms that are the lowest and least developed. The higher the effort accomplished, the more richly endowed the organism of the species, the greater the chances of inequality. In so high and developed a natural movement as man, equality of individual opportunity is conceivable. Equality of natural powers and accomplishment is a chimera. Nor will the generalization of powers or the increase of material make any difference to the level of natural attainment. All the accumulated discoveries and varied information of the modern scientist will not make him mentally the superior of Aristotle or Socrates. He is neither an acuter mind nor a greater mental force. Nor all the varied activities of modern philanthropy will not produce a greater moral type than Buddha or St. Francis. The invention of the motor car will not make up for the lost swiftness and endurance, nor gymnastics restore the physical capacity of the Negro or the American Indian. We see, therefore, the limits of nature's possibilities in the human symbol, fixed by the character of the symbol itself, and recognized by her in her strivings. It is still a question whether, in these limits, the chief preoccupation of nature is the exhaustion of the possibilities of the human symbol. That is rather man's preoccupation, and therefore the direction she takes when human intellect interferes with her normal progression. Left to herself, and even utilizing human interferences, she seems bent rather on breaking the mold than on perfecting it. Only indeed in her more advanced individuals and more daring movements, and with due regard to the safety of the general human type. But this is always her method when she wishes to advance to a fresh symbol without destroying the anterior species. The more civilized man becomes, the more she plagues him with moral abnormalities, excesses of vice and virtue, and confusions of the very type of vice and virtue, the more he intellectualizes, the more he insists on rationality as his utmost bourne, the more she becomes dissatisfied and clamors to him to develop rather his instincts and his intuitions. The more he strives after health and hygiene, the more she multiplies diseases and insanities of mind and body. He has triumphed over supernaturalism. He has chained her down to the material, human and rational. Immediately, she breaks out fiercely into unthought of revivals and gigantic supernaturalisms. Whatever work she is intent on, she will not be balked in that work by the limited human reason. Through all her vast being, she feels the pulsation of a supernatural power, the workings and strivings of a knowledge superior to material reason. She breaks out, therefore, she compels, she insists. Everywhere we see her striving to break the mental, moral, and physical type she has created and to get beyond it to some new processes as yet not clearly discerned. She attacks deliberately the sound healthfulness and equilibrium of our normal type of intellectuality, morality, and physical being. and she is stricken also with a mania of colossalism, colossal structures, colossal combinations, colossal heights and speeds, colossal dreams and ambitions outline themselves everywhere, more or less clearly, more or less dimly. Unable as yet to do her will in the individual, she works with masses. Unable in the mind, with material forms and inventions. Unable in actualities, with hopes and dreams. Unable to reproduce or produce Napoleons and super-Napoleons, she generalizes a greater reach of human capacity from which they may hereafter emerge more easily. And meanwhile, she creates instead dreadnoughts and super-dreadnoughts, trusts and mammoth combines, teams with distance destroying inventions, and seems eager and furious to trample to pieces the limitations of space and time she herself has created. As if to point her finger to the thing she intends, she has accumulated the signs of this process of breaking and rebuilding in the phenomena of genius. It is now common knowledge that genius hardly appears in the human species unattended, unprepared, or unaccompanied by abnormalities in the individual body, vitality, and mind which contains it. Degeneration, insanity, or freak in the hereditary which produces it, and even disturbance and supranormality in the human environment in which it occurs. The haste of a brilliant generalization establishes on this basis the paradox that genius itself is a morbid phenomenon of insanity or degeneration. The true explanation is sufficiently clear. In order to establish genius in the human system, nature is compelled to disturb and partially break the normality of that system, because she is introducing into it an element that is alien as it is superior to the type which it enriches. Genius is not the perfect evolution of that new and divine element. It's only a beginning, or at the highest an approximation in certain directions. It works fitfully and uncertainly in the midst of an enormous mass of somewhat disordered human mentality, vital, nervosity, physical animality. The thing itself is divine. It is only the undivine mold in which it works that is, to a lesser or greater extent, broken and plowed up by the unassimilated force that works in it. Sometimes there is an element in the divine intruder which lays its hand on the mold and sustains it, so that it does not break at all, nor is flawed. Or if there is a disturbance, it is slight and negligible. Such an element there was in Caesar, in Shakespeare, in Goethe. Sometimes also a force appears to which we can no longer apply the description of genius without being hopelessly inadequate in our terminology. Then those who have eyes to see bow down and confess the avatar. For it is often the work of the avatar to typify already, partly or on the whole, what nature has not yet effected in the mass or even in the individual, so that his passing may stamp it on the material ether in which we live. But what is this type of which the Great Mother is in labor? What birth will emerge from the cries and throes of this prolonged and mighty pregnancy? a greater type of humanity, it may be said. But in order to understand what we are saying, we must first see clearly what the humanity is which she seeks to surpass. This human symbol, this type we now are, is a mental being with a mental ego, working in a vital case by mind always, but upon matter, in matter, and through matter. It is limited in its higher workings by its lower instruments. Its basis of mind is egoistic, sensational, and determined by experience and environment. Its knowledge, therefore, pursues wider or narrower circles in a fixed and meager range. Its moral temperament and action is similarly egoistic, sensational, experiential, and determined by environment. And for this reason, it is bound equally to sin and virtue, and all attempts radically to moralize the race within the limits of its egoistic nature have been and must necessarily, in spite of particular modifications, end in general failure. It is not only a mixed, but a confused type, body and vitality, interfering with mind, and mind both hampered by a hampering body and vitality. Its search for knowledge, founded on sense contact, is a groping like that of a man finding his way in a forest at night. It makes acquaintance with its limits of egoistic nature, have been and must necessarily, in spite of particular modifications, end in general failure. Although it has an uncertain light of reason given it, which partially corrects this disability, but since reason has also to start from the senses, which are consistent falsifiers of values, rational knowledge is not only restricted, but pursued by vast dimnesses and uncertainties, even in that which it seems to itself to have grasped. It secures a few flowers of truth by rummaging in a thorny hedge of doubts and errors. The actions of the type also are breaking through thickets, a sanguine yet tormented stumbling forward through eager failures to partial and temporary successes. Immensely superior to all else that nature had yet affected, this type is yet so burdened with disabilities that, if it were impossible to break its mold and go forward, there would be much justification for those pessimistic philosophies which despair of life and see in the will not to live humanity's only door of escape, admitting to it no other salvation. But nature is the will of the all-wise God, and she is not working out a reduction of the world to absurdity. She knows her goal. She knows that man, as he is at present, is only a transitional type. And so far as she can consistently with the survival of the type, she presses forward to what she has seen in God's eternal knowledge as standing beyond. From this ego, she moves towards a universal consciousness. From this limitation to a free movement in infinity, from this twilight and groping mind to the direct sunlit vision of things, from this conflict without issue between vice and virtue, to a walking that keeps spontaneously to a God-appointed path, and from this broken and grief-besieged action to a joyous and free activity, and from this confused strife of our members to a purified, unentangled, and harmonious combination. From this materialized mentality to an idealized and illuminated life, body, and mind. From the symbol to reality. From man separated from God to man in God and God in man. In brief, as she has aspired successfully from matter to life, from life to mind and mental ego, so she aspires, and with a fated success, to an element beyond mind, the Vijnana of the Hindus, the self-luminous idea or truth self, now concealed and superconscious in man and the world. As life was always concealed in matter and mind in life. Now, what this Vijnana is, we have yet to see. But through it, she knows she can lay firm hold on that highest term of all, which is the reality of all symbols in spirit, in Satchidananda. The aim of nature is also the aim of yoga. Yoga, like nature at its summit, seeks to break this mold of ego, this mold of mentalized life, body, and materialized mind, in order to achieve ideal action, ideal truth, and infinite freedom in our spiritual being. To effect so enormous an end, great and dangerous processes have to be used. Those who have been eager on this road or have opened up new paths towards the goal have had to affront as a possibility frequently realized loss of reason, loss of life and health, or dissolution of the moral being. Now, they are not to be pitied or scorned even when they succumb. Rather, are they martyrs for humanity's progress. Far more than the lost navigator or the ancient scientist slain by the dangers of his investigation. They prepare consciently the highest possible achievement towards which the rest of humanity instinctively and unconsciously moves. And we may even say that yoga is the appointed means nature holds in reserve for the accomplishment of her end, when she has finished her long labor of evolving at least a part of humanity temperamentally equal to the effort and intellectually, morally, and physically prepared for success. Nature moves towards supernature. Yoga moves towards God. The world impulse and the human aspiration are one movement and the same journey. Now, if this is the nature of the operation to be effected, not a perfection of the present human mold, but a breaking of it to proceed to a higher type, what then is the power and process that works it out? What is this nature of which we speak so fluently? We habitually talk of it as if it were something mighty and conscious that lives and plans. We credit it with an aim, with wisdom to pursue that aim, and with power to effect what it pursues. Are we justified in our language by the actualities of the universe? Or is this merely our inveterate habit of applying human figures to non-human things and the workings of intelligence to non-intelligent processes which come right because they must and not because they will, and produce this magnificent ordered universe by some dumb, blind, and brute necessity inconceivable in its origin, and nature to intelligent beings. If so, this blind brute force has produced something higher than itself, something which did not exist preconceived in its bosom or in any way belong to it. We cannot understand what being and nature are. Not because we are as yet too small and limited, but because we are too much above being and nature. Our intelligence is a luminous freak in a darkness from which it was impossibly produced, since nothing in that darkness justified itself as a cause of its creation. Unless mind was inherent in brute matter, and in that case matter is only apparently brute, it was impossible for matter to produce mind. But since this leads us to an impossibility, it cannot be the truth. We must suppose, then, if matter is brute, then mind is also brute, and intelligence is an illusion. There is nothing but a shock of material impacts creating vibrations and reactions of matter which translate themselves into the phenomena of intelligence. We will pause at this point for today, and we will continue in the next episode. It's so good that you've listened. May the listening open at least a tiny fissure in your soul, your heart of light, in this day, in this night. Until next time, signing off for now, Marlenka.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the City of Dome.